A recent piece in Time magazine asked some provocative questions about U.S. defense spending, such as, does the Navy really need 50 attack submarines when America's main enemy hides in caves? Or does the Army still need 80,000 troops in Europe, 66 years after the defeat of Hitler? The U.S. spends about as much on its military as the rest of the world combined. And it's borrowing much of that from China to pay for weapons that could ultimately be used against Beijing. Well, Time magazine national security correspondent Mark Thompson wrote, "The Chinese don't need to attack us with missiles. They just have to call in their loans." And Mark joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Mark, welcome.
Hello.
Your piece in Time magazine suggests that cutting $1 trillion from the Pentagon budget wouldn't be as drastic as it sounds, really, and that the U.S. military, even with those cuts, would still be the most potent in the world. Where could that level of cutting take place, really, without having a huge effect?
Well, I think it's important for folks to realize that the waste, fraud, and abuse, the perennials that defense hawks and doves always cite as a way to cut defense spending, really won't do it here if we're talking about cutting $1 trillion over roughly a $7 trillion spending plan for the next decade. What the government, what the Congress has to do is say, okay, we're going to spend that much money because we're doing 10 pounds worth of missions. And if we're going to continue to do 10 pounds worth of missions, we're going to need that much money. Obviously, the only way to save $1 trillion over the coming decade is to trim back on some of those missions. And if you went into a more restrained national security strategy instead of a forward-leaning national security strategy, it would not be that hard to get there.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the specifics of how you get to a restrained capacity. Where are some of the major areas that you think could be reduced or spending could be reduced on?
Well, plainly, our forces in Asia, in Korea and Japan, that's a heritage of World War II, as well as in Germany. I mean, we're talking 150,000, 200,000 folks there, as many as we have in Afghanistan and Iraq in hot wars these days. It's the payroll that really drives the Pentagon budget. It was about 30 years ago in Time magazine, we had a story called How to Spend $1 trillion, talking about Cap Weinberger and the Reagan defense buildup. Here we are a generation later, and the question isn't how to spend $1 trillion, it's how to save $1 trillion. I mean, look at it this way. Look at the Persian Gulf. When Jimmy Carter decided to deploy the Rapid Deployment Force to protect the flow of oil everywhere in the world through the Strait of Hormuz, since he made that commitment, we, the United States, have spent roughly $7 trillion doing that on military forces, which just happens to be how much we're going to spend over the coming decade. Yet, the entire world is dependent on that oil, and we, by and large, are shouldering the entire cost of keeping that pipeline secure.
So the U.S. basically is subsidizing the cost for many of its allies here because we have such a powerful military.
Yeah, not only there, of course, you know, Europe, as we're now seeing in Libya, has a difficult time amassing any military operation. You know, we are the world's lone superpower, so it's fair that they lean on us for some stuff. We're spending double or triple what our fellow NATO allies are spending, and in effect, our high spending on our military is subsidizing their social welfare programs.
If we talk about payroll in the Pentagon, I was astonished to read in your piece about the bonuses that went to some military members to reenlist, and also their health care benefits. You know, we've heard an awful lot lately about trimming the benefits of public employees because of the difficult budget times, but not much about trimming any benefits for military workers.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's an interesting issue. The Pentagon, for the last half a dozen years, has recommended raises for troops that are roughly a little ahead of inflation. And every year, Congress has increased that beyond what the Pentagon has recommended. And, you know, when you're a young soldier and maybe you've been in 4 years or 8 years and your spouse wants you to get out, if you can get a $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 bonus to sign up for another 3, 4, 5, or 6 years, That's a very handsome enticement. And basically, the military has done a pretty good job during this decade of war. Folks have said the army is on the verge of breaking. We've written about this. The army has not broken. It's very resilient. It's having troubles, you know, with PTSD, suicide, and stuff like that. But basically, the force remains intact.
In your story, you said 60 crewmen from one ship received $3.4 million in reenlistment bonuses.
Yeah, I mean, that was on the USS Abraham Lincoln. Those worked out to about $57,000 per sailor for an average re-upping of, I don't know, 4, 5, or 6 years. Interestingly, sailors are encouraged to re-up when they're in the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Sea because Congress has designated that a war zone. And because it's a war zone, they get these bonuses tax-free.
But what about, actual equipment and things like that? Because here we are, we're talking about bonuses to folks on an aircraft carrier, which Defense Secretary Gates, raised the question, do we really need 11 aircraft carrier striker groups for another 30 years when no other country has more than one? How significant is it, do you think, that he even asked that question?
Well, I think it's pretty significant. Let's review our history here. Aircraft carriers are a fruit of the pre-World War II industrial might of the United States. They are big, fat targets. They remain, along with submarines, the two preeminent punches that we can throw at a potential foe. I don't believe for fiscal economic reasons that war with China is likely, but China is working feverishly to develop missiles, especially to kill these, 4-acre floating pieces of sovereign American territory. So I think what Gates has asked is a logical question, which is this the best we can do in the 21st century to project power far from home, from the sea? And a growing number of people don't think it is the best, most optimum, most value-filled way to do that.
What do you think is, equipment-wise, and what we're using militarily, is sort of the most glaring example of where we could do better if we updated?
Well, I mean, when you talk about updating, for example, the U.S. military currently flies the finest fighters in the world, and it has thousands of them. Certain folks will always point out that, well, the Russians are on the cusp of developing this Gigaw, or the Chinese have just flown the J-20. I mean, frankly, give me a break. We hear about these things all the time. They never come online in a quantity and in a way to affect the global balance of power. So why, pray tell, is this nation now buying 2,500 $150 million F-35 fighters. We could, as someone who has flown an F-16 with new and better engines and new and better electronics and new and better munitions, keep our current fleet of warplanes the best in the world for the next 20 or 30 years without buying a new plane.
We're talking with Time Magazine national security correspondent Mark Thompson. His recent article recommends how the U.S. might cut $1 trillion in defense spending. And Mark, you've written about how the Pentagon could trim personnel and bases and equipment, but what about the political environment in which these decisions are made? These three things all equal a lot of jobs. So if you do cut, you're affecting somebody's livelihood.
Yeah, that's true. And as someone who grew up just south of Boston, down in Rhode Island, and had lots of friends' fathers who worked at Electric Boat making nuclear submarines, it was always striking that those folks lived so well compared to the rest of us. How come these folks who are building these jets, who are building these submarines, have such well-paying jobs when the people supporting the purchase of those weapons aren't doing so well? I fear we run a risk of a backlash if we don't get this thing more in equilibrium. If this is to be the equivalent of, a works progress administration like we had in the Great Depression, let's call it that. Let's not say it's vital for national defense. Let's cut the charade. And then I think the whole thing collapses like a house of cards.
But it is difficult to sympathize with cutting the military when you have so much going on militarily. We've got a war in Afghanistan. We're finishing up in Iraq. We're involved in Libya, I guess is the best way to put it. We've got all of this stuff going on, and you're saying cut. Aside from the economic things, we've also got military action happening.
Yeah, well, let's look at that the way they look at it here in Washington with the green eye shades. The wars are funded via a separate budget. They are not funded in the Pentagon budget. If we cut the Pentagon budget, it's not going to affect the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, the quasi-war in Libya. Most folks don't know that, and it gets complicated, but you just need to understand. Think of it as having two separate budgets. There's a defense budget, which buys stuff and pays people, and then there's a war budget. You can keep funding that one, premium high test, for as long as you want, while curtailing the defense budget.
Mm-hmm. But if we do, and if that is how we're paying our military, you're also suggesting cuts in that at a time when people are very sympathetic to folks in the military because they're obviously risking their lives to do their jobs.
That's true, but a couple of points on that score, Deb. Number one, they're all volunteers. Number two, a recent New York Times CBS poll said, okay, let's look at the big three in our government spending, Social Security, Medicare, and defense. If you could only cut one of those, which would you cut? And overwhelmingly, the folks selected, let's cut defense before we cut Social Security and Medicare. I'm not advocating cuts. What I'm advocating is a clear-eyed look at what we're spending stuff on, and are we spending it at the right rate and in the right places? In some ways, what we've got, I think, for those of us of a certain cohort, is, you know, Fred Flintstone or some cartoon character from long ago who's run off the cliff, and he hasn't looked down yet, and he's still suspended in midair because we have not had the important post-9/11 conversation, which is, yikes, it's been a decade since 9/11 happened. We've engaged in two full-throated wars. I don't feel any safer.
But at the same time, we hear from folks who would disagree with making significant cuts to defense spending. They say, you know, but remember 9/11. We have to protect ourselves. And if we cut the budget, it shows that America's in a decline, in a weaker nation. So what would you say to that?
Well, number one, America is a poorer nation. There's no doubt about that. Given that we're borrowing so much money, given that we're borrowing it allegedly from a prospective foe, how long can this continue? The issue is defending the national security of the country. I think we've gotten away from that, especially since 9/11. We now go poking around the world, be it Indonesia or anywhere, the Philippines, as if this is a vital threat to the United States of America. I don't think we've had a vital threat since the Soviet Union fell apart a generation ago. Yet we are now spending more money today than we did during the Cold War. And to your opening comment, our military cannot stop 9/11s. You cannot stop an individual small band of persons willing to kill themselves. What we've got to do is ensure we do as much as we possibly can to suppress them. Remember, on 9/11, the bad guys used as weapons our airplanes against our skyscrapers.
You know, we're hearing a lot about what's happening on both sides here as this budget debate heats up in Washington. And the congressional newspaper, The Hill, says there's a resignation, really, among a lot of Republican lawmakers that cuts are ahead. There will be Defense Department cuts. But aren't we hearing real proposals from lawmakers or any signs that there might be consensus about where there could be some trimming?
Well, there's no consensus yet, but it's getting closer every day. I mean, I think it's important to note, first of all, that when Secretary Gates and President Obama talk about the initial round of $400 billion in cuts, you know, check your wallets. Those aren't cuts. They are reductions in the rate of growth. Secondly, you're getting folks like Congressman Barney Frank and folks like Congressman Ron Paul, a left-winger and a right-winger, coming together. And that group is definitely growing. Ash Carter, the Pentagon's top weapons buyer, talked that big cuts are coming and including weapons platforms. And as Gordon Adams told me in my piece in the current issue of Time, he used to run the OMB shop responsible for monitoring the Pentagon during the Clinton administration. And it was his estimate that one out of every three defense dollars is spent simply because lawmaker X or Senator Y wants to keep that money flowing to his or her district or state. I mean, I was frankly surprised that the number Gordon pegged was that high. Secretary Gates, to his credit, has killed several important high-profile programs. So these things are possible to do. I'd like to see lawmakers have the guts to say, this is what we need, this is what we don't need. But who knows? Anything is possible in this current environment.
Mark Thompson, national security correspondent for Time Magazine, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.